5 p.m. on a Monday, and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from Kingston, Ontario. Coming up next, today in YGK.
Hey, Kingston, let's take a walk together for awareness, fundraising, and fun. Join us for the 2026 Kingston Canada Walks for Bladder Cancer event happening at Lake Ontario Park on Sunday, September 13th, 2026 at 9:30 a.m. Gather your friends, family, and colleagues and team up for a day by the water supporting Bladder Cancer Canada and register now at bccwalk.ca. Great fun for a great cause. See you on September 13th.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
It's 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK brings you the latest with local headlines, Queen's Campus news, sports, weather, traffic, and upcoming events. Delivered by CFRC's News Collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, and Henry Walker. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and for our podcast, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. With unanimous support from Council, the city is undertaking a review of the Animal Control Bylaw and related policies and procedures concerning dogs, after recent incidents involving dogs have raised community concerns. Just last month in Portsmouth Village, Kingston resident Leah DePaw's one-year-old Dachshund was killed by an off-leash dog in a traumatic attack. She spoke before council at their August meeting detailing the attack and what she described as a lack of urgency and communication in bylaw's response to the incident. In response to this devastating incident, as well as ongoing concerns from residents related to off-leash activity and dangerous dogs, Councillor Wendy Stephen brought forward the motion to investigate whether more can be done to toughen existing policies.
I know that to many people, dogs aren't just seen as pets. They're considered to be important members of the family. But like most things, there are multiple truths here. So it's also true that councillors receive regular complaints from constituents about off-leash dogs in public places, and it's an ongoing problem. I'm really hopeful that this motion is a step in the right direction to us trying to address these concerns. At the core, the motion is about making sure everyone can safely enjoy our public spaces. It directs staff to review the city's policies and compare to other municipalities to make sure we are using best practices to balance the needs of dog owners with the safety, comfort, and enjoyment of others who use our public spaces. Because our parks, our trails, our sidewalks, and our public spaces are for everyone.
Currently, bylaw can administer monetary penalties through the Animal Control Bylaw, and if required, can escalate issues to the Ontario Court of Justice under the Dog Owners Liability Act. The review will examine the city's off-leash and dogs-at-large rules, enforcement and legal tools available within the legislative authority available to municipalities, preventative measures, penalties, and support for dog attack victims. DePaw returned to council to speak in support of the motion to review existing policy and advocating for stronger deterrence and a more victim-centered approach.
You may remember that I was here last month and spoke to you about a horrific incident in which my dog and myself were attacked by a large breed power dog, and my little sweet Bumsa was killed in the attack. I'm happy to see that at this month's meeting, there's a motion on the floor to look at assessing the responsible pet ownership bylaw. Oftentimes, the only consequence is education for the dog owner and a muzzle order, which is very different from facial scarring that someone might have for their whole life or the loss of a close pet. There's also an approach to victims that increases trauma and decreases safety. When communicating with victims of a dog attack and mauling, Kingston's current practice is the same as any other bylaw. They'll tell you that an investigation has been started. The investigation is complete. The city has taken an enforcement action, and the city's enforcement action is complete. This differs significantly from Ontario's Victim Bill of Rights.
Portsmouth Councillor Don Amos seconded the motion, stating that this has been an ongoing issue for his constituents.
In my district, I have a family that's in mourning. I have a neighborhood that's in fear. And this motion coming forward, I think, will help with some of those mechanisms of what is needed. You saw tonight from Ms. Dupu, her comments in the previous council when she was here making comments. Her family is struggling, and she and I have had a number of emails exchanging, trying to help navigate this motion, and I appreciate the mover bringing this forward and allowing me to add some stuff to it. I'm hoping this will give the staff more tools. I fully welcome the review. The number one complaint I get about the biggest park in my district, Lake Ontario Park, is off-leash dogs. And we need a mechanism for owners to seriously understand that not everyone has a love for animals or it gets nervous when a dog comes running up at them, even if it's in fun or in jest, or you can see the happy smile on the dog. Not everyone is able to accept that with open arms. And there's a reason we need to have our dogs on a leash. The other aspect is the Victims' Bill of Rights. I think that's a mechanism that is needed to improve our communication with the victim so that they are kept a little bit more in the loop, as much as they can be. And I think that will help through with the process of what is being identified here. So happy to support. And I'm hoping this is a step in the right direction for our staff to give them some more tools.
Councillor Brandon Tozzo raised the issue of enforcement capacity, which has at large been a challenge for bylaw recently.
It's good to have policy on the books, but we also have to have the staff and staff members to enforce it.
Staff responded that the review will include examining this piece and consider whether more bylaw officers should be a priority in the 2027 city budget. Staff will report back to council with any recommended amendments in the coming months.
We have a huge amount of off-leash dog opportunities for people who want to use them. It's really difficult because it's so simple, right? Just leash your dog in a public place. It's not a difficult message to deliver, but I think part of it too is I can't remember who mentioned it, but You get in your head that I love my dog and so therefore everybody else must too. I think part of this too is being able to take different perspectives, being able to be a fully grown adult and taking the perspective of a child who is at face height with a dog is a very different experience. So I'm sure staff will come up with some great communication tools. I know that we've all been, you know, working through the off-leash dog situation, but I'm hopeful that this is a step in the right direction and that we'll see some traction here and perhaps some behavior change.
Council voted to defer changes to the yards bylaw pertaining to naturalized lawns at their last meeting earlier this week after input from local experts. Changes to the yards bylaw were proposed in response to an increase in complaints to the city related to lawn grass, unmanaged vegetation, and properties being represented as naturalized lawns. The current yards bylaw establishes a maximum height requirement for turf grass of 8 inches and prohibited plants, but does not define exactly what constitutes a naturalized lawn. According to the report from staff outlining the changes, this lack of specificity has led to inconsistencies in interpretation, uncertainty for residents, and challenges enforcing the bylaw in, quote, a fair, transparent, and defensible manner, end quote. Councillors echoed the key challenge, determining the objective factors that can be used to identify negligence from deliberate design.
Because I think the issues that we as council have had is not intentioned, it's just people with lawns that are just left to grow wild due to negligence. So there still is, I think what we're looking for council is some way to address negligent lawns versus intentionality.
The report that came before council recommended amendments to the yards bylaw that provide clear definitions, objective maintenance standards and enforcement practices, and alignment with best practices across Ontario. Staff also recommended that a standardized naturalized lawn assessment framework be created to support consistent enforcement. However, Joyce Hostin with Thousand Islands Master Gardeners, a local group of volunteers with horticultural expertise that were consulted on the current yard bylaw in 2024, came before council to request the motion be deferred. Hostin argued that the proposed changes could actually create unnecessary barriers for residents who wish to maintain naturalized gardens.
Kingston, so already has a strong bylaw. This amendment, though, is a step backward.
Maintained naturalized landscapes can contribute positively to biodiversity, pollinator habitat, and climate resilience. They can also reduce irrigation demands, increase native vegetation, improve soil health, and support urban biodiversity. At the same time, neglected, quote-unquote, naturalized lawns can lead to health and safety concerns, including fire hazards, invasive species, obstructed sightlines, pest harborage, and other conditions that may negatively affect the community. While opposed to immediate larger changes to the bylaw, Hostin agreed that a standardized naturalized lawn assessment framework would aid bylaw in making the distinction between a naturalized lawn and a neglected one.
Education, communication, and trained bylaw officers who can tell the difference between naturalized yarn and neglected yarn and a yarn dominated by invasive plants will help people make the transition.
Hostin argued that there are already key indicators which can be used to make the call, including the enforceable standards for grass height and prohibited plants.
What signals intent? And I think there's things like, are there more pollinators? Are there more birds? Does the biodiversity increasing? And is the land healing? Is it absorbing more stormwater? So those, to me, are signals of intent. And then having a conversation with the homeowner, if you talk to a homeowner and they can tell you that some of the plants, so they can actually say, oh, this is this plant, that signals intent. If they don't know what the names of the plants, then they maybe are just being neglectful. Or the prohibited plants. The prohibited plants list is really valuable because if they're neglecting their yards, odds are they've got prohibited plants. If they're deliberately naturalizing, they would know those prohibited plants and they would be removing them. I visited 5 yards with bylaw since the new bylaw came into effect. So bylaw officers asked me to come out and help. And I went out and in every one there were prohibited plants. So those are 2 things that are already in the bylaw that allows for that complaint to be upheld.
Hostin also noted the importance of establishing clear expectations now, as more Kingstonians consider transitioning away from traditional turf.
We also have to get used to a different aesthetic, that it is going to look messier than we're used to. That's part of biodiversity. And so being able to, I think, when somebody emails and I'd be happy to help with some bullet points or something to address when homeowner complains and it looks messy, because if there's more pollinators, if there's birds and there's bees, that mess is inviting life to the yard. I would say it's a matter of time for people to adjust to the new normal. And that new normal is going to take some time. Before, and we need a lot more examples of the naturalized yards. The Master Gardeners have run 2 biodiverse garden tours, which is part of that whole effort. And we will be holding one. The last one was last year, so every 2 years. Last year's was the front yard garden tour to show examples. And in that one, we had over 200 people come out. Most the first one, not nearly so many, and they were mostly just curious. This last one was people who were wanting to naturalize, not sure how to go about it, and looking for examples.
Councillor Wendy Stephen put forward the motion to defer, proposing staff return in the final quarter of 2026 to allow time to consult with Thousand Islands Master Gardeners on any proposed changes.
I think this is a direction that we're headed, and I'm really excited to see Kingston as one of the leaders in these naturalized lawns. And I think as part of this new normal, it is messy, and it is hard to define. We are in uncharted waters here, and I think that, you know, staff and the Thousand Islands Master Gardeners, they worked really, really well together to get this bylaw so strong. And I think the intentions here are right and good, and I think that
we can make them even better if we give just a little bit more time for consultation with Thousand Islands Master Gardeners. The whole point of this isn't that we're opening up really broadly to have a huge discussion. That's already happened. That work is done. This is just about making sure that the enforcement piece is in place. So I think Thousand Islands Master Gardeners are the ones that can help us with this.
That wraps up your headlines for this evening. Next up is Jesse Bell with your CFRC Sports Desk.
Thank you, Chris. This is Jesse Bell with your sports report brought to you by CFRC Power Plays. It's Labor Day, so I wanted to do a deep dive on a CFL franchise that is on the verge of setting the wrong kind of history. With roots dating back to the late 1870s, the Ottawa Red Blacks, formerly known as the Ottawa Rough Riders, formerly known as the Ottawa Senators, were one of the CFL's charter members. The franchise would spend 48 of their 120 seasons playing in Canada's professional league, fielding some true titans of the sport. Canadian greats like Ron Stewart, Russ Jackson, and Tony Gabriel all saw meaningful playing time for a franchise that would lift the Grey Cup 9 times in total. An ill-fated American expansion of the CFL in the 1990s had dire consequences for the league, as all but one franchise reported losses in the 1996 season. These losses, combined with front office mismanagement and ineptitude, resulted in the folding of the Ottawa Football franchise, leaving the city without professional football for the first time since the establishment of the CFL in 1956. In 2002, the Ottawa Renegades would be added to the CFL as an expansion team, a second life for pro football in the city of Ottawa. The team lasted 4 seasons before financial insolvency once again stripped the nation's capital of its team. The new-look Ottawa franchise never tallied a winning record, going 23-49 in 4 playoffless years. The second resurrection of Ottawa football occurred in 2014, this one with a more stable and locally focused ownership group led by Ottawa 67's owner, Jeff Hunt. A new stadium was commissioned, albeit with a lot of political machination along the way, and the Ottawa franchise was christened as the Red Blacks, a name paying direct homage to the franchise's one consistent thing, its color scheme. The 2014 Red Blacks were terrible, but that was to be expected from an expansion franchise, as they finished 2-16. The 2015 team finished that season strong to go 12-6, and actually made it to the 2015 Grey Cup, the first Ottawa team to do so since 1981. The Red Blacks would ultimately lose 26-20 to Edmonton, but the journey was far more important than the result. Ottawa had orchestrated a massive turnaround in just one season, as they went from cellar dwellers to the Grey Cup favorites in 2016. Unfortunately, 2016 was a bit of a letdown for the team, at least during the regular season, as they finished with a losing record of 8-9-1. However, the East was so weak that year that Ottawa was able to make the playoffs as the number one seed in the East, earning a first-round bye and home field advantage. This paid dividends for Ottawa, as they ended up hosting the higher-seeded Edmonton Eskimos, and the franchise would earn a measure of revenge for their 2015 defeat, beating Edmonton 35-23 to book their ticket back to the Grey Cup. Ottawa would upset the heavily favored Calgary Stampeders in overtime 39-33 to win the first Grey Cup of the Red Blacks era, and the first for any Ottawa football team in 40 years. Ottawa remained competitive for the rest of the 2010s. They tallied a winning record in 2018, going 11-7. Then they fell on hard times towards the end of the decade and the start of the next. They went 3-15 in 2019, 3-11 in 2021, 4-14 in 2022 and 2023, before finally finishing over 500 again in 2024 with a 9-8-1 record. Ottawa's struggles had been masked partly by the immense struggles of another franchise, that being the Edmonton Elk, who amassed a record-setting 23 consecutive home losses between 2019 and 2023. Unfortunately for Ottawa, the spotlight has been firmly on them for the past 12 months. September 5th, 2025. Ottawa beats the BC Lions 34-33 at home to move to 4-8 on the season.
They dropped their remaining six games to finish 4-14. A bad end to a rough season, but they did secure the first overall pick in the CFL draft that they would use on offensive lineman Giordano Vaccaro. Expectations for the franchise were low going into 2026. Ottawa would start things off with an 8-point loss to Edmonton in week 1. They followed that up with a 44-24 loss to Toronto in week 3 and a narrow 37-35 loss to a skilled Montreal team on the road. They lost by 5 to Saskatchewan at home before getting blown out by Edmonton on the road. 5 games and 5 straight losses for Ottawa. The Red Blacks lost a close one to Winnipeg 36-34, which at the time of publication is the closest Ottawa has come to winning a game since September 2025. They are currently last in the CFL with an 0-11 record, and when you combine these 11 straight 2026 losses with their 6 straight 2025 defeats, it gives Ottawa the longest losing streak in the CFL era with 17 in a row, and the second longest professional losing streak in Canadian history behind the Ottawa Rough Riders from the late 1920s, early 1930s, who lost 25 consecutive games from 1928 to 1932. Saturday marked a full calendar year since Ottawa's last win, and this current squad does not look like they'll be able to change that. The good news is, Ottawa cannot tie or break the all-time record this year, as there are only 7 games remaining. The bad news is, no CFL team has ever finished a season winless, and Ottawa looks primed to do exactly that. What does the future hold for the Ottawa Red Blacks? Well, if we look at the history of the franchise, we see a fraught path ahead. Ottawa's home game attendance has cratered in 2026. Their last game against BC saw just 13,000 people attend, down 3,300 from the previous home game. Money is always tight in the CFL, but doubly so for a franchise that has already folded twice in the last 30 years. If this franchise cannot right the ship and put a watchable product on the field, Ottawa may indeed bid adieu to their pro team for the third time in as many decades. That is a wrap for your sports report brought to you by CFRC Power Plays. Coming up next, we have traffic and weather for the Kingston region. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. South Bartlett Street is closed from Victoria to 15 South Bartlett while the contractor undertakes facade restorations at 655 Princess Street. Expected completion is September 30th by 7 p.m. Right Crescent at Palace Road to Palace Road is closed for a contractor to complete roadway repairs, pedestrian safety and access improvements, and traffic calming features on Right Crescent. Norman Rogers Drive from Sir John A. Macdonald Boulevard to Van Order Drive will be closed to through traffic to facilitate roadway rehabilitation and configuration improvements. The City of Kingston and Utilities Kingston are in the midst of a major reconstruction of Princess Street. This major infrastructure project includes upgrades to underground and above ground utilities, as well as improvements to enhance safety and comfort for pedestrians and cyclists. Berry Street to Queen Street is closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street, and Aberdeen Street from Johnson to William is closed to accommodate construction and staging activity. This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Monday, September 7th, Labor Day, 24 degrees is your high with a mix of sun and cloud, looking like it will be a beautiful Labor Day here in the City of Kingston. Tuesday, September 8th, 22 is your high, feeling a degree warmer at 23 with a mix of sun and cloud, with the cloud coverage giving way to sunnier conditions in the afternoon. Wednesday, September 9th, 23 is your high, humid conditions, a 66% chance of rain with afternoon thundershowers in the forecast. Thursday, September 10th, 20 degrees is your high, breezy conditions with that 70% chance of rain in the afternoon, so definitely a holdover from the rainy, stormy conditions on Wednesday. Friday, September 11th, 18 is your high, feeling 2 degrees warmer at 20, beautiful start to the weekend. And on the note of the weekend, Saturday, September 12th, we have a high of 22 with sunny conditions. Great time to check out some Queens football as they host the Waterloo Warriors at Richardson with a 5 p.m. kickoff. Sunday, September 13th, 21 is your high with a 76% chance of precipitation. And starting off next week, Monday, September 14th, 20 degrees is your high, feeling like 20 with sunny and clear conditions.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and listen on the go, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and for our podcast, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.
We know now that in the early years of the 20th century, this world was being watched closely by intelligences greater than man's, yet as mortal as his own. We know now that as human beings busied themselves about their various concerns, they were scrutinized and studied, perhaps almost as narrowly as a man with a microscope might scrutinize the transient creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water.
This is Eli with Off the Record on CFRC 101.9 FM. Tune in every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for a wide range of alternative music and just whatever I feel like. And remember,
this is strictly Off the Record.
We'll start with some general ways to turn ugly duckling emotions into swans. First,
rock, 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 rock it.
Second, third, this is what one doctor suggests.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Number 7. Now, look forward in a positive mode. Start by spending a few minutes
each Thursday at 10 p.m. listening to Bright Side of the Poo. What's it about? A way of life.
Number 10. Give unto others. Reach out to those you can help or inspire. Now, it's time to flip this tape. On side two, you'll find a wonderful, calming relaxation exercise.
There's no place like home.
There really is no place like home. It's where life happens, where dreams are built, and where you land at the end of every day. But what home looks like is different for everyone. Welcome to Finding Your Way Home, Real Talk on Real Estate. I'm Sherry Doherty, and together we'll explore what finding your way home truly means, whether you're buying your first place, making a move, investing, or choosing a different path altogether. Because home isn't just a place, it's a feeling, it's a choice, and it's personal. Tune in Mondays at 10 a.m. and start finding your way home.
My name is Genevieve, and I'll be hosting Peace, Love, and Jenny on CFRC 101.9 FM on Saturday evenings at 8 p.m. We'll be exploring everything from pop and soul to funk, jazz, and even a touch of hip-hop. Music that spans decades but all connects through good vibes, peace and love, and of course, a little bit of me, Jenny. See you there!
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. This is edition 333, and I'm Stefan Christoff. Thanks for tuning in. This show is part of a series of conversations with cultural workers in Mexico City called Transbordar in transit, and it's connected to a zine publication that I launched during the Suoni Peri Popolo Festival in Montreal in June 2026. On this edition, I'm going to be sharing a conversation with Jose Ortega of the Project 316 Centro. This is a really interesting cultural space that opened up in a part of downtown Mexico City that really is outside of the waves of gentrification that have affected Mexico City in recent years. And it's in a more popular neighborhood, and it has been a really important space for contemporary experimental music in Mexico City. Jose speaks about the project, but also some of the ideas and the community around it, and some of the challenges they've had to navigate in Mexico City, being an autonomous cultural center for concerts and really a network of contemporary musicians working in Mexico City today. It's really an interesting and insightful conversation with Jose, and I'll share it here on this week's edition of Free City Radio. So maybe just to start, Jose, if you could introduce yourself. You've been involved in independent cultural spaces a lot in Mexico City, and 316 Centro is one of them, but it's part of a whole ecosystem. So maybe you could just start with a brief introduction and just sort of a picture of some of the grassroots efforts that you've been involved in to create space for independent music in Mexico City.
Yeah, well, hello, everybody. My name is Jose Cortez. I'm from Mexico City. I've been involved within like the music and the arts within this country, within this city. I'm also like a composer and, well, what we call like a cultural manager, I don't know the term in English, gestor cultural in Spanish. And yeah, basically like, well, it's not only me, but it's like just like a community effort that we've been developing since the last almost 10 years, like that it has led upon like creating like a healthy ecosystem for different kind of expressions to take place within the city, because there are many, this is like one of the biggest cities in the world, and like of course there's a lot of demand and a lot of offer around art. And well, what has happened also lately these years is that there's a lot of people that don't even know that they are into that kind, to some kind of music, into some kind of genres, into some kind of communities. They don't even, were not, some people, it's not even aware that there's all these kind of things taking place in their own cities, because there's a lack of spaces. Like everything has been like, I don't know, the last decades in the 2000s, for example, it was like already co-opted by, I don't know, like government institutions, that everything had to be like institutional or either like hyper commercial stuff. So like that creates some sort of alienation sense of the cultural life in this city. So I don't know, like a lot of people have been making so many efforts. So we have like the opportunity, like on this place on the periphery of the downtown that has been like almost forgotten by authorities, forgotten by society itself, like people live there in some kind of abandonment, that's where we could like find like the safe space for making all this flourish and all that. And has been like, at some extent, was really organic, like people got attracted into it, all the proposals that we didn't even know they existed, like got attracted into it, and they all nourished the place. We just like got the opportunity to make this space, and I don't know, like the social inertia by itself aligned into that.
Just for people who are a little bit unaware, you talked about the physical space that you've been involved in the last years, 316 Centro, but also you talked about the center of Mexico City. So just for people who are hearing this, just describe a little bit more the sort of location.
Yeah, this is like, well, it's a downtown. It's like the core life of the Mexico City life, happens there, but still there are many, like, within that downtown, there are many zones, you know, like the touristic zone, like the commercial zone, and there's this part called the Barrio de la Merced neighborhood, that is where one of the oldest markets of Mexico is located. This is a market that existed since, like, the Aztec Empire days, the prehispanic times. It was like a neural point. It was just like around commerce and all that. And then it became like kind of abandoned. Well, that market is still there. Their life, it still happens there. But the people that live around there has been kind of abandoned. And now, like, it was been a zone since many decades have been co-opted by prostitution, drug traffic, and also many migrants, like inner migrants, like people from the far away places, like the Oaxaca, Chiapas, like the mountain zones, indigenous people come to live in Mexico City looking for opportunities. And that's the only place, because it's like a blind spot of the downtown. It's on the, how you call it, like the east part of the downtown. Because it's like a blind spot, it's where they can live there. And also, like, our space is like, it's a building of like five floors, and some of them are populated by these kind of migrants. And now with this new influx and these new dynamics of Latin America, now it's being populated by Venezuelan communities, Haitians, Cubans. Yeah, like, has been even more multicultural. But yeah, it's like it's a mixture. Like, if you go to a bar into that zone, you can listen to like different languages, like 10 different languages in the same place, and they all belong to the same country, you know, like, and so that's how it's that zone. And it's like, as I mentioned, it's a blind spot. So no, even authorities could be aware of, like, oh, something's happening there. There's like a live concert place or whatever things. In the first beginnings, they didn't even care about, like, that neighborhood.
And it's really interesting to just think about the fact you mentioned multiple languages. Of course, you're talking about, you know, Haitian Creole, Portuguese, but also many indigenous languages in Mexico. And other countries in the region. Thanks for sharing this sort of context about the space that you've carved out. Maybe just a little bit more about the challenges you're facing now, because I know that in Mexico City right now, there's a huge struggle around gentrification and, you know, communities affording the center of the city. And this has been also impacting cultural spaces like yours in 2026 now.
Well, yeah, actually, like, since the coronavirus, well, the gentrification has been arrived since many decades, like, maybe these famous neighborhoods like Roma, Condesa, that used to be like a hobo neighborhood, and now it's like really fancy. But in this case of La Merced neighborhood, that is a place that we thought like it was never going to happen. And it's still like a slow process, but like, just to give you like a wide, quick picture, like, it's been like some, like, 2 years ago, they put like a Carl's Jr. restaurant in front of our venue. And even before, there was something impossible to happen. But it was these small steps, like, around gentrification, but now it accelerated. But here in Mexico, it has like a little spice, a different spice that is compared with what has happened, like, I don't know, in Montreal or in Berlin or these kind of big cities, that it's like merely like, I don't know how to call it, like entrepreneurs, like immobiliary entrepreneurs, like doing their stuff, trying to raise prices to make like even more badass buildings or whatever. Here is like, we are surrounded by these three entities that are right now ruling mostly the downtown. One is like the government. The government that is kind of harassing you. Like, at some extent, we are, like, recognized as an organization that is involved into arts and all that, and that's what justify our activities at some extent. But they still looking like how to get some more bribes, how to get more money, how to harass you at some extent. This is like the government. The other stuff is like with the mafia, like they call Unión Tepito, like this organized crime that controls many stuff around this the city life. And these are the ones that they seek, they want to see how is your business working on, if you can sell drugs in there. And you know, the government doesn't care, because the government and the mafia is almost kind of the same thing. Like, if they can sell drugs there, or you have to pay some monthly fee and all that. And the third actor that is like the commercial one that right now is co-opting like the downtown are the Chinese commerce. Like, right now the downtown is getting a huge radical transformation that they're turning, like, I don't know if you know this website called Alibaba, they're turning the whole downtown on a huge Alibaba, like all these huge warehouses, and they're like pushing all the people that are living there, like the owners of the buildings and all that, they're pushing them to sell to these people. They're like they're using like many all the means they have available to push people to sell it. So yeah, we have been receiving a little bit of that pressure, but fortunately, at some extent, because the nature of what we do, for example, we were not of not interest for the mafias. Like, they got in and they thought they were going to find a club where that was already packed and, I don't know, like a huge business happening there. And they just saw some, like, weirdos, harsh noisers, like, so, like, what the fuck is this? Okay, just take care, dude. Well, like, the Chinese stuff is like, yeah, we're not selling, so get out of here. Like, well, we are not the owners of the buildings, but the actual owners are like, no, you stay calm with that. But right now is the World Cup coming up. So right now, like, I don't know, the city, at some extent, they know that some kind of nightlife, some cultural life needs to happen. And not everything can happen within a fancy place or within this framework of, like, I don't know, making a huge club or whatever. So they allowed many, many parties, many underground parties, many concerts to happen. But now they put their aim into these kind of even independent, like, micro-nano organizers. Like, they want to clean the city. They want to, like, okay, something cultural happened, it must happen within the scope of a huge corporation that already, like, I don't know, like, this kind of allies of Live Nation and all that, that they're, like, mounting clubs, concert halls and all that. Now the World Cup, this city needs to look clean, needs to look neat. Now, we, like, all the cultural life needs to happen within that scope. So that's right now, like, the fight that we are having.
Well, I see what you're saying also around financialization, because cities get this whole process, are facing this process of financialization, where buildings and housing is sort of folded into these property investments that are then sort of bet on through stock traders and so on. And with Live Nation and Spotify and what's happening with music, the same thing is happening. You know, artists, song rights, and then also, of course, the touring process and concerts are also being folded into this sort of financialization of music that's driven by the same investment capital. This is like a confluence of so many forces that is, like, on the ground right now in Mexico City in this very violent way, as gentrification has really sped up in recent years. And it's really meaningful to hear from you, Jose, a little bit about the sort of dynamics in this particular neighborhood where you sort of carved out this space. And, you know, so just maybe just to end, if you could talk a little bit about about that, about the importance of people, like, because there's a lot of attention right now on Mexico City and a lot of people like thinking about that space. And so, you know, on a sort of absurdist level, one of the views could just be like, oh, this is sort of like a landscape of the forgotten place that, you know, American artists are sort of coming to, or even Canadian artists, without understanding these local dynamics. So maybe just, you know, we're going to be launching this zine in the context of the Suoni Paripopolo Festival in June. So maybe just talking about why it's important for artists and activists to have that more nuanced understanding of, you know, experiences of artists or cultural workers like you in sustaining spaces in Mexico City and the challenges faced.
Well, yeah, totally. First, like, I believe, like, the first phrase that comes into my mind, like, when thinking about why we need all this is, like, firstly, like, to sustain culture, like, culture in general as a human, social entity that lives around us. We need counterculture. We need like this other side of the coin. Even like the talking about like this like music that is only seen as an investment and all that, like as a stock, as an asset. It's like even that music needs like all the weirdos that have been working and breaking their asses for many years or in order to get ideas, you know, like, I don't know, like, for example, I don't know, this album of Rosalía Motomami, something like that was called, like, it was produced by Arca and all that. And all that sounds is like just like the reflection of what has happened like a decade ago of all these weird artists that have been doing like all this weird shit, all this weird stuff, and needed these kind of spaces and these kind of places for nurturing their own art at some extent. And on the other hand, like also, I believe really firmly we are living like really weird times where we no longer, like, this is widely discussed, like, we no longer what's real or what's not real with all this AI stuff, that suddenly you're listening to some Spotify and then you listen, I don't know, to some post-rock or ambient playlist, and then sometimes, like, oh, this sounds really clean, what's this artist, and then, like, who's that? And you investigate and it doesn't even exist. And it's like, you know, if you want things get real, now is the time. Really, like, it's more urgent than anywhere in any other time in this century of getting close, like face to face to what you are listening to, you know, to make sure you're listening to a human. You need to see that human. You need to get more involved with the guy next door, what he is doing, and we need to recontextualize this other language that is music, that is art, that is a human language. It's another way of communicating and getting closer to ourselves, and perhaps step off of that logic of something needs to get bigger. Oh, he's a cool artist and now he's going to play in a theater and now on a stadium and blah. No, it's like, it's a social practice. We need to stimulate that. And also we need to be conscious about how all that, those spaces, that management, all that works, is working. And it's a cycle. Even like, I don't know, the beer that you're buying to the venue is contributing to all that dynamic that it's really hard to sustain and really hard to maintain. Like, people also need to differentiate among like what's like nation and what's an independent stuff, you know. Okay, yeah, if you want to sneak your alcohol into Coachella, go ahead, like, good for you. No, you're not giving your money to those guys, but literally if you're in a small venue, like, you're not taking advantage of anything. You're just hoarding yourself if you enjoy music and you're trying to be like, oh, I'm not giving to these independent organizers my money and all that. Well, dude, you're just damaging like the music you say you love.
Well, I think, you know, what you mentioned about being in person, like being face to face, being in a community context where we see each other, and the way that that nurtures creativity, you know, 316 Centro was, and, you know, remains like a reference point for so many independent creators, sound artists, noise, people making noise music, poets, in the city. So it's really important to hear your perspective and context around the challenges that you have faced as a cultural worker trying to create that space right now in Mexico City with all the intersecting points of violence around financial capital and gentrification. Thank you, Jose, for talking today.
Yeah, no, thank you, Stefan. It's been a really pleasure to talk to you, always.
That was a conversation with Jose Artiga of 316 Centro, which has been a really important cultural space in downtown Mexico City. And it's really a pleasure to speak with Jose as part of this series within Free City Radio, featuring voices of cultural workers in Mexico City called Transbordar. This series has been produced in collaboration with the Suoni Peripopolo Festival and launched as a zine in 2026 in June. Free City Radio broadcasts on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. on CJLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Thursdays at 8 a.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. and Fridays at 1:30 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m. on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m. on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m. on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You can also find us as a podcast. Just search Free City Radio and find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll be back with you next week. Thank you.